I was planning to be in Haiti. It doesn't look like we will be in Haiti, given the unrest that's going down there. Carl has already made the wise decision to say no. Mark and I are trying to act like big boys, like we're still going, but I think my heart says no, we're not going. But it's certainly a tough time in Haiti. It's a tough country in general, but a lot of unrest, and maybe reading some news on some missionary nurses down there that just did a GoFundMe to get out of there, and they're safe and things. So just a lot of different turmoil and things going on. So pray for the Christians in Haiti and so forth. And regardless of that, next week Doug Emmett will share, and so I'll either get to be in the audience and heckle, which is always fun, but as he's done before, he'll do a wonderful job, I'm sure. So hopefully I can get us through 38 today, so he can have a clean starting point on chapter 39. So just kind of a quick review. Remember, 37 is comprising the first act of this narrative on Joseph that's going to go through chapter 47. And there's five scenes in this first act that chart Joseph's progression from what I've termed preferred to put out. So scene one was kind of this overall context, not only for this act, but for the whole Joseph narrative in 37 to 47. We get kind of the high-level context. Scene two presents the plot line through his prophetic dreams, and we see the things happening there. Scene three set the stage for the revenge, and that's where we ended up last week. So where we'll pick it up this week is in scene four, which is going to present the brothers' conspiracy against Joseph, their attempt to destroy him, and by destroying him, thinking that they'll destroy the dreams, kind of reminds us of the New Testament narrative, right? What did they think they'd do? What did Satan think he'd do by destroying Christ? He thought he'd destroy Christ's work. What happened? Of course, no, he just abetted it and helped it along in the process. And then the final scene, concluding Act 1, is the family's distinctive birthmark. We see deception again and again and again. Now, someone read verses 18 to 28, and we'll get started here. Okay, thank you, Danae. So we get into the scene. It opens with this summary statement that gives us, the readers, a full preview. So again, like a lot of these narratives, we're clued into what's going on right up front, but obviously the characters in the act don't know. Now, the brothers' reaction to Joseph proceeds in two stages. They have two reactions. What are their two reactions? How do they respond to his coming? What are their thoughts?
First, to kill him.
Hey, you got it. Let's just kill that dreamer. I can just see him sneering. Here comes that dreamer. We're going to get him, right? Okay, so first act is to kill him. What's the other one?
To sell him.
They're going to sell him. Okay, right. Okay, the first one is kill him. So it was emotional. Let's get him. And the second one was a little bit more pragmatic. No, let's sell him. Okay, so we see there kind of two responses. So in verses 19 to 20, the brothers are all in. So they purpose to kill him, thinking it was going to change the outcome of his dreams, right? They figure, well, we'll get this dreamer out of the way, then we won't have to worry about the dreams. So we start there. Now, they were of one accord to get rid of the dreamer. They won't even call him by his name. So kind of, what words would you think of to kind of describe what this is like? I kind of gave you the sneering piece. What other kind of attitudes do you think they're reflecting towards their brother here?
Very deep jealousy.
Deep jealousy, yep. Hatred, we know that. What else?
Contempt.
What's that?
Contempt.
Contempt, yeah, a lot of good words. So, you know, disdain, derision, scorn, contempt. I mean, it's just nothing good and nothing redeeming about how they're reacting to their brother in the process. And, of course, you see the family DNA at work, right? We'll kill him, and what do we tell Dad? Well, we'll tell him a wild beast eat him. Now, again, all lies are based in what? Some element of truth, right? So that the lie comes across, we see the process there. Now, it's been so long since you got your homework. This was the second homework assignment, right? And the question was, beyond the obvious, who intervenes and why? So everybody gets the who. We don't have to get in there, right? Who intervenes in this? Reuben. Reuben, okay. And why? Why does Reuben intervene? What's his motivation for intervening, do you think?
Restoration.
Restoration, okay. What do you mean by that?
He wants to get back to his father's good graces, get his position back.
Okay, yep. I think that's one possibility. Yeah, what else?
Didn't want his brother's blood on his hands?
Yeah, kind of the same type of thing, but maybe a different slight twist on that. Of course, it is Reuben. The idea that simply to avoid more trouble with his father, right? So he didn't want his brother's blood on his hands because as the firstborn, he would have been held responsible for his brother. But as Jonathan mentioned, I think it's really more this second idea of atoning for his prior sins against his father. So he's seeking some level of restoration, okay? Whether he's truly repentant or not is kind of hard to do, and it may be a little bit of both of the two, but those are the possible motivations for what he's doing. So maybe Reuben has begun to kind of change a bit in the process of his character. We don't really know. So whichever option you choose, his actions, I think, draw some sympathy, right? He is riding against his brothers, but as the narrative is going to prove, it's not timely, nor is it bold, right, yielding an important implication. And that's this. If you're going to stand against sin, you need to do it openly, early, and fully. Half-hearted measures are only going to yield half-hearted results, right? So think about it in your lives, right? You know, Mark's going through Matthew 18, right? So what's the character of this church restoration process as he's titled it? Well, it's a persevering work through several stages of going to a sinning brother or sister, right, to fully confront the situation. So when you're going to confront sin, you have to be prepared to stand against it. You need to be prepared to work through the entire scenario. If you don't, and you go at it half-heartedly, you're going to see half-hearted results, which is certainly what Reuben saw in this particular situation. So something to think about. I also think it's important to think about what you're confronting, right? I mean, you know, we're not running around as the sin police. If we are, we ought to be policing who?
Ourselves.
There we go. We get the old mirror out and we point it this way, right? But the fact of the matter is we do look at sin. We look at persistency, and I think we're getting a good series of teaching here, so I'll leave off at that. So stage one of the conspiracy ends with the brothers buy into Reuben's plan, right? So they buy in, and what do? They throw him into this pit. This pit was probably a cistern. It probably collected water during the rainy season, but at this time it's dry. Now, they sit down to a family meal, right? Hey, great. We just threw the kid into the pit. What do we do? Let's eat.
Celebrate.
Let's eat. Let's celebrate. Okay, so what descriptions come to mind from this reaction? Well, again, kind of complete indifference, no conscience, maybe just complete hard-heartedness, but it's just kind of, it's a little bit beyond me to think. I mean, so this pit's not that far away. Commentators come up with all a bunch of reasons to get how many yards it is, but close enough that they can hear him, okay? So he's right there, of course, until later, right? So let's look at Genesis 42 just for a second. We'll skip ahead in the story. In 42, we're actually told how Joseph was reacting to this situation. In verses 21 and 22, actually, I'll start back here in 20. You know, this is when he's been down there, and Joseph's, you know, commanding them to bring their youngest brother back to me, so your words may be verified, and you will not die. And they did so. Then they said to one another, truly we are guilty concerning our brother, because we saw the distress of his soul when he pleaded with us, yet we would not listen. Therefore, this distress has come upon us. Reuben answered them, saying, did I not tell you, do not sin against the boy? And you would not listen. Now comes the reckoning for his blood. Okay, so there's going to be a reckoning, even though the text here doesn't say that he's, you know, screaming and appealing to them. We learn, obviously, later that he did. So they're sitting down there chomping on a meal. Their brother's in the pit screaming for mercy, right? And they're just completely ignoring the process. So while the text doesn't tell us that he was pleading, 42 certainly does. And it also, again, reminds us that God's justice may not be immediate, right? But it will come. And this is really kind of the process, I think, that we all need to think about. Sometimes when we do and we sin and something goes wrong, what do we generally think? Well, just buried under the table here for a while. It really won't be a problem, but it's always going to come back and bite you in the rear end at some point in time. Okay, God's just not going to let it go. Okay, so opportunity knocks in verse 25. Dothan, where they were pasturing, is a crossroads for one of the two routes for traveling down to Egypt. So you remember there's the one route that's east of the Jordan River, comes down south of the Dead Sea, and then cuts over through the Negev territory. The other one crosses over further north, or even north of the Sea of Galilee, and comes down through Dothan. So it was a crossroads for caravans that were bringing things down. Now, last homework assignment we had was who takes the lead in part two and why? Okay, so who takes the lead in this part of the act here, the scene?
Judah.
Okay, so Judah takes the lead. Now, the bigger question is, why does Judah take the lead? I mean, Reuben took the lead before. Why does Judah take the lead now?
Well, hadn't Reuben left?
Well, it's a good speculation, but we're not told.
It says he returned to the pit.
Yeah. Yeah, he returned to the pit. It doesn't tell us he had left. We have to speculate on that. You're right. We'll ask that question in just a second. But why Judah? I mean, why does Judah take the lead here?
Money.
Huh?
Money. The money.
Yeah, money.
He saw an opportunity to pick up some coin.
Yeah, 20 shekels? These guys are loaded. That's like picking up a fiver. Now, that may be a lot to me, but, you know, maybe. I don't think so. What else?
Maybe he thought he could take the next position.
Ah.
Joseph is out of the way.
Okay, well, we're getting close here, right? So who, Judah, why? He had the most to gain from Joseph's removal, okay? Now, why did he have the most to gain from his removal? Sequentially, he was next in line with regard to the birthright inheritance. Reuben had already disqualified himself, right? Who else disqualified themselves?
Simeon and Levi.
Right, by doing what?
Killing all of them.
You know, whacking all the Shechemites, right? Okay, killing all of them, right? And so who's next? Judah's fourth in line. So he would be the one next logically to receive the birthright, okay? So he certainly had the most to gain. So, Jim, you were right. It was money. It just wasn't the 20 shekels. He was looking for the big payday, you know, when he would get twice of the scenario. Now, he doesn't succeed with regard to the birthright, right? We learn later who does get the birthright. Joseph and his two sons, right? But what does he get?
The Messiah.
The Messiah, okay? He's in the Messianic line, okay? So kind of an interesting scenario in terms of as I go through. Now, how do you feel about his little speech in 26 and 27? How do you feel about Judah's little speech there?
For show.
Yeah, show. I mean, are you kidding me? I mean, it's completely sanctimonious, right? Certainly insincere, and of course, deceptive, right? So you just see the family DNA. It just keeps coming out and coming out in the process. His brothers buy into the plan. They sell him to a passing caravan of Midianite traders for the price of a slave. Now, as you go further into the Old Testament, you'll see the price of a slave was indeed 20 shekels, and that's what they sold him for. Now, commentators like to go wild on this. Well, it says Ishmaelites and Midianites, so it can't be true. It's not accurate. The Bible's not accurate. Well, no, it isn't. Ishmaelites is just the general name given to the non-preferred line, okay? It's everybody that descended from Ishmael, right? He was the first one. The Midianites are just a branch within that line. So it's just like us saying anybody beyond the Middle East are Arabs, right? So if I just labeled everybody out there Arabs, Jordanians would say, no, I'm a Jordanian. Saudi Arabians would say, I'm Saudi Arabian. They would relate more to their ethnic grouping, and that's all that's going on here. Okay, so don't get carried away on something wrong or incorrect. Now, there really is a great irony as we leave the scene. Okay, there's a great irony as we leave this scene. And what is it? What's the irony? Remember, the brothers were going to do this, right? So let's kill this dreamer, and then we'll see what he gets done. So what's the great irony here?
He's going to get more done.
What's that?
He's going to get more done because they didn't kill him.
Mm-hmm. Well, they didn't kill him, but the point is that their actions that sought to rid themselves of Joseph, what? They served to actualize the very dreams that they tried to subvert, right? So they just served to actualize them because now we're going to accomplish it, right? So demonstrating once again God's sovereignty in the affairs of men. Right? So God is working sovereignly in all these affairs of men. He works to bring about his purposes in the midst of our failures, and Joseph lives to play another day, not for Joseph's sake, but to advance what? God's redemptive plan and the process, right? So, I thought I had something else in there. All right, let me read this next section. I want to make sure we can kind of get moving here. 29 to 36, the final section. Now Reuben returned to the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit, so he tore his garments. He returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is not there. As for me, where am I to go?" So they took Joseph's tunic and slaughtered a male goat and dipped the tunic in the blood. And they sent the very colored tunic and brought it to their father and said, "We found this place. Please examine it to see whether it is your son's tunic or not." Then he examined it and said, "It is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." So Jacob tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. Then all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, "Surely I will go down to Sheol in mourning for my son." So his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer and the captain of the guard. Now, the final scene opens with Reuben's discovery that the pit was empty, right? So now we'll get back to the question that you said, where's Waldo, right? Where is Reuben during this whole process? What do you think? They were having dinner and he was out to lunch. That's interesting.
He could have been checking on the flocks.
Ah, there you go. I think that's good sanctified speculation. We're not told, okay? But likely it was his watch, right? It was his watch in that he was in the field watching over the flock. So he got then, he figured, hey, everything's good, I'm okay. He goes out, he's got the watch in the field. Which reminds us, what? That God is provident over things, what? Big and small, right? All the little details, right? That's where I thought I had this. Now, don't ask me how it works, right? How does God's providence work? And how does the volitional will of man work? Anybody got an answer to that one?
Yes.
Does it have to do with, like, restraining grace?
Yeah, no, it's got to do with it's a mystery. Well, it doesn't tell us.
I mean, as far as them killing him,
yeah.
Is that God's restraining?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. But the fact is that God, the Bible tells us very clearly that God is sovereign in every detail, right? Sovereign means sovereign. That means over everything, right? I put on these black socks. They happen to match this morning. Is he involved in that? I don't know. Somehow, probably. You know, we go through the process. But the fact of the matter is God is working through people to accomplish his purposes. Here's the thing that we have to remember. The Bible clearly asserts both things are true, right? Anybody question that? No question about that. Now, what does the Bible fail to tell us? What's that? Exactly right. Right? It is a mystery. You know, it's Deuteronomy 29:29. God tells us what he wants us to know, and the stuff he doesn't want to know, he keeps to himself. Right? So that's when we get into the whole Nike thing, just do it. Right? But the fact of the matter is that these things do work together. It really is mind-boggling when you think about it. Right? So my analogy every time is, right, the little Rubik's Cube, right? That's only three-dimensional. Now, some of you are probably smart people and can get those things to all line up. I basically can get those things to stick to the wall when I've thrown it against the wall when I'm tired that I can't get the colors to line up, right? And think of the dimensions that God's working with in the plan that he's working in this whole redemptive scenario. So, you know, I think the other thing to do, though, sometimes when we think about God's will, I think we tend to trivialize it to us, right? Because what is it we really want to know? We don't really care about God's will. We want to know what's God's will for me.
We don't need right? to know.
Well, we don't need to know because he told us. But God does tell us his will. At a macro level, what is God's will? What's the macro level of God's will?
Obey him.
Obey him, right? Well, what's God after?
To glorify himself.
Glorify himself, absolutely. And how is he glorifying himself? But what?
Through our obedience.
Well, through our obedience, no. But more specifically.
Our love.
No.
Conforming us to the image of Christ.
Yeah, that's. We'll get to that one. That's part B. Before he can conform you to the image of Christ, what does he have to do?
Save us.
He's got to save you. All right? So what's God's redemptive plan? What's his primary will? He wants that all should come to saving faith and none should perish, right? That's at the top level. So we're down in the weeds here. Do you want me to marry her? Do you want me to take that job? Do you want me to do this? No. What he wants is everybody come to saving faith, right? And then once that's happened, Jonathan, right, what does he want us to do?
Be conformed
to the image of his son, Jesus Christ, okay? So I think we got to, you know, whenever I get stuck on this, I try to just go back up to the big picture, right? Now, does he have a specific will in our lives and certain things? Sure. Does there a plan? Yeah. Okay, but it's a complicated topic. The fact is that both things are true, and the Bible does not tell us how they work, okay? So it is a mystery, and we have to accept it as that. Yes?
Not to go into great details, but everybody knows I like to cook cookies, and I
didn't see cookies back there.
I had some extra ones, and I know a couple that are elderly in our neighborhood, and I stopped the other day to drop off some just because they like it. He had an aneurysm and was having hospice care, and I had no idea.
Wow.
And I met with his daughter, gave the cookies to her, and she said, I can't talk to you right now. The hospice people are here. I had no idea. She called me last night and said, you cannot put into words how much my dad appreciated. I said, I had nothing to do with that
right.
timing.
Yeah.
And that's exactly. One of those examples that if we aren't open to God's will,
right.
that, you know, we think, oh, everything's, you know, in our control. I bake the cookie, that dropped me.
Yeah, what do we do?
Yeah.
But, you know, it's also how God gives us opportunities to witness, right?
Yeah.
He opens that door. He said, yeah, you have the right answer. Well, that was me. I mean, it was God. He knew this, and, you know, what's important for you to understand is this, okay? So, look, we see God's will at work in things big and small, right? So he had the one guy that was trying to prevent it, Reuben, in the field, so he wasn't there. So anyway, Reuben bemoans his fate in verse 30, right? Comes back essentially saying, what am I going to tell Dad? Okay, I'm in big trouble now. The kid's gone. Right, so whichever way, to which the ever-ready deceptive brothers have a solution ready at hand. What's the solution? What
did
you tell
them?
Yeah, we'll tell them that the animals ate them, right? So once again, a deceptive lie. Now, what's ironic about the ruse? What's ironic about the ruse they employ?
Yeah,
kind of the same thing, using the same deal, right? Goats, right?
Yeah.
So he was deceived by goat hair and goat meat, and now they're going to deceive him with goat blood. But there was something quite a bit more sneaky about their ruse. What was a little bit more sneaky about what they did?
Use his coat.
Yeah.
They did that, right? That wasn't sneaky. That was the evidence. What was the sneaky part?
They let their father make the decision.
Exactly right. Right? That's right. They caused Jacob to pronounce the outcome. Right? They just present the evidence. Oh, is it your son's tunic? Right? They just let him present the evidence. And what does Jacob do? Well, he pronounces the outcome. So, well, you know, it's kind of like, well, I didn't really lie, right? Really? Okay. Yeah, well, we just say, well, here it is, and so forth and so on. So what's interesting about Jacob's response? Now, when Jacob tried to deceive his father, Isaac kind of went through a few test steps, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Come over here and let me have a sniff.
Right.
You know, let me touch your arms. I mean, he was testing it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Jacob doesn't seem to be the least bit suspicious.
Well, it was his own idea.
Well, it was his
if
own idea.
If they had come and just lied to him, he might have been more suspicious.
Yeah.
But letting somebody come to their own conclusion, who's he going to challenge?
Well,
I mean,
right.
It's his idea.
Well, I get it. That's fair. Roger?
But through this whole thing, he knows that there's been deception and anger and turmoil
right.
between all of the brothers and Joseph.
Right.
Yeah.
So why wouldn't he start thinking a second time, wait a minute, they're bringing me the evidence?
Yeah.
And they're not saying?
Yeah. I mean, even though he pronounces it, yeah, I get that. What
it kind of shows that Jacob doesn't believe God. Doesn't believe in the goodness of God. He doesn't see the promises that God gave Joseph as being true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he's not ultimately turning to the Lord in this grief either.
Right. No, absolutely not. I mean, we don't see anything really spiritual in Jacob's reaction and response. But to me, at least, it's a bit surprising that he just kind of accepts it and jumps to the conclusion. You're right, Betty. I mean, he does.
Well,
he does make his point, and that's what he concludes.
Not
but.
Only that, I think we all tend to lie to ourselves when the truth is something that it would be even worse.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, okay.
I think sometimes we unconsciously choose to believe one thing because facing the facts.
Right. So it's bad enough my son's dead. I don't want to believe that my other sons
killed him
or had something to do with it. Yeah, I think that's fair. Yeah, I think that's fair. There's kind of a lot of things that go on. This is why I say, you know, we got to kind of try to put ourselves in the shoes of the individuals. We're speculating, okay? Don't really know. But to me, it's just a little surprising that he doesn't poke a bit harder. He doesn't look closer at the tunic, you know. I don't know if you can tell the difference between goat blood and human blood. To me, blood's blood. I don't want to get anywhere near any of it. But the process is, you know, it's a little thing. So, as we and the brothers would expect, Jacob responded with grief and mourning. Yeah, Jim.
You know what occurred to me as I was looking at the text here is that this is a wilderness. What's the possibility of them finding his robe out there in the middle of nowhere? I mean, think
right.
about it.
Right, right. It was really drug off by a wild animal.
But I mean, think about it. You got all this barren area out there, and they find his robe. This happened to find his robe.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just having it, maybe, did they tear it up a little bit? Did they make it look like it was done? I mean, complicit. Mm-hmm. Anybody that's been there, who's been to Israel and some of those areas? They're pretty remote, aren't they? I think you've said that a few times, right? So, yeah, I think Jim makes a good point. I mean, what's the chance?
Yeah.
Right. So there are all kind of a lot of opportunities, I think, for Jacob to be a little more suspicious, but for whatever reason, he's not.
It said in the previous verses, though, that he remembers Joseph's dream,
mm-hmm.
you know, so you would think he'd be puzzling over, well, if he's dead,
right?
How could this dream be?
Right.
How does that fit in with the dream?
Yeah, right. Yeah, so I think, you know, again, I think there's just a lot of reasons as you reason through what's happened so far that it's just a little odd that Jacob isn't a bit more, you know, suspicious, questioning, contentious, wondering, but yeah.
Cause well, and he might be, and we just don't know.
Yeah, they just.
Well, I think that's the point at the end of when he says that he can't be comforted by any of them. He goes into his own mourning.
Yeah, okay, so what is surprising about the mourning? The extent and its inconsolability, Jacob refused to be comforted, but why do you think so? I mean, why would he refuse to be comforted? I mean, if he kind of accepted this as true, and then he mourns forever.
I think part of it has to do with the fact that he probably in the back of his mind wonders why his other sons didn't protect his son.
Yeah, maybe. Okay, Roger.
I mean, you know, he was his favorite son.
Yeah.
And
he wasn't the brother's favorite son,
no.
though. Roger?
Remember, he sent them. He sent them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
Jacob sent Joseph to the brothers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It could be some guilt.
Guilt.
Okay, well, I hadn't thought of that. That's possibly. He could feel guilty. Yeah. He could feel guilty about that. Yeah. What other thoughts? That's a good idea.
Do you think he felt that if they were comforting him, it was superficial because he knew that they didn't care for him or had jealousy
right.
there?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
speculate a little bit.
Let me ask you, was there maybe a divine reason for it? Did you have an idea, Jonathan?
I had a little half-hearted
alligator arm there? Or?
No arm. I think that it, you know, you talked about deceit being one of the patterns, but favoritism is as well.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, we see that pattern throughout,
yeah.
right, throughout all the families. Okay. Well, again, this is all sanctified speculation, okay? So certainly favoritism, right? I mean, he did have a deep love for Joseph.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question. I didn't think of that one, Roger. I think that's possible, too. He might have felt guilty, like, oh, man, what was I doing sending him out? I'm just asking for this kind of thing. But more so, I think maybe that God wants to sear the brothers' consciences, right? So there's another thought here that there's the sense that he really wants to sear the brothers' consciences about what they did here, right? Because they're trying to console him. Yeah, Doug.
As when you went to the scripture couple where the brothers come back, you know, and see Joseph. I mean,
right.
You see they carry that for 13 years.
Right.
It's fresh on their heart. So
right.
As soon as they're like, you know, so that, yeah. That's one of the reasons I think Judah went out from the presence of his father.
Yeah.
He couldn't take it.
Well, there you go.
He
That's
had
good.
Had to get out of there because there was this constant guilt pressing upon him.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a good introduction to our next chapter, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Okay, so more so that, is he prolonging the guilt and discomfort, perhaps giving him an opportunity to come clean and repent? I think that's probably a stretch. Okay, but the fact is, I think God's searing their consciences,
mm-hmm.
all right? And we do see that as we carry through the scriptures. Or like Pharaoh, he's hardening their hearts. So Act 1 ends with the summary statement as to Joseph's fate in verse 36, which is also going to serve as the transition to the rest of the Joseph story. So like a lot of Old Testament narrative, you kind of have the big buildup and so forth, and boom, you get to the end. There's a quick transition statement, and you're on to the next thing, okay? So which leads us to chapter 38. Now, this 38 is an interesting chapter, right? At first blush, it doesn't look like it fits, right? It's like, where does this come from, okay? Where do we go from here? What's the point of this? So I've entitled this, The Danger of Worldly Entanglements. So it's a sordid affair in every way. One of the commentaries I read is a guy named Leupold. He's a good old commentator. And he has a little thing at the end of each of his commentary chapters. And he has homiletical uses for the chapter. And his point here is there's absolutely no homiletical use whatsoever. In your right mind, you would never talk about this chapter. I'm like, Leupold, what about 2 Corinthians or 2 Timothy 3 and all scripture is good and so forth? But the fact is, he's kind of funny. You know, it is a sordid story, right? So for me, it's one of the proof points of the veracity of scripture, right? Because if you're really putting something together that's not from God, you ain't going to include this chapter, right?
And one of the profound things is that this is exactly what the genealogy of Christ goes to.
Exactly right.
So, I mean, if there's anything you'd want to keep out of his genealogy,
Right, that it comes from such a thing. We'll look at that in just a second, okay, in terms of some different things. You look at the people that God puts in Christ's genealogy, and there's some sort of thing. Like Genesis 36, this is actually parenthetical, right? So if you read the last verse of chapter 37 and you read the first verse of chapter 39, the story follows perfectly, right? So it's pausing to develop the messianic line. And I think the chapter's purpose is twofold. One is to demonstrate the dangers of worldly entanglements, right? So they're kind of explaining this again. We see this issue. We had one example of it back in Shechem. But also, I think it's to give us God's motivation for sequestering them in Egypt, right? He's going to sequester the nation in Egypt. And we're getting some insight from this chapter as to why God does that, because they're becoming entangled with the world, and he doesn't want that to be the case. Now, anyone know why Egypt was the perfect place? Scripture is going to tell us in just a few verses. Anyone know why Egypt was the perfect place for them to be sequestered?
Water and food.
Well, after the famine, yeah. Okay, so go to Genesis 46, 33 and 34. All right. Genesis 46, 33 and 34. Now they've come down, right? And they're going to meet Pharaoh. And Joseph gives them instructions what to say. When Pharaoh calls you and says, what is your occupation? Verse 34, you shall say, your servants have been keepers of livestock from our youth even until now, both we and our fathers, that you may live in the land of Goshen. For every shepherd is what? Loathsome to the Egyptians, right? So what does this move guarantee?
Hatred.
Well, hatred, yeah, but it guarantees kind of a built-in protection, right? The Egyptians are not going to be attracted to try to intermarry or anything with this. So God puts them in kind of the perfect place with a perfect scenario. So again, he's in charge of things big and small. So he sequesters them in the perfect place. Now the chapter's pretty straightforward. Kind of swiftly go through the events. I want to highlight two topics, one of which is levirate marriage. We're going to see that here. And then the women and Jesus' genealogy. Okay? Now, structure of the chapter, right? First five verses, we see that Judah strikes out, is what it says. So you got a little double entendre there, right? He struck out from the family, and he certainly struck out in terms of his actions when he was there. Then we have Tamar's plight in verses 6 to 11, followed by her plan to rectify things, okay, in verses 12 to 19. Judah's predicament in verses 20 to 23, and then his pronouncements on her pregnancy in verses 24 to 26. And then you know, because I'm just such a weenie, I have to come up with a P word for the last one, right? So we have a little quiz this week, and we have a reward. We have a gift card here. $10 Starbucks gift card. If anybody can get what the next P word means, because I learned a new word, okay? The last section is Tamar's parturition. Tamar's parturition, right? Living proof I'm a weenie. I have to find something for a pee. I don't do this every week, but parturition. Anybody know what parturition means?
Pregnancy.
Parting, what?
Pregnancy.
Pregnancy, okay.
A parturian is somebody who has been pregnant, had a baby.
Okay.
But so. Doesn't it have to do with the coming down the line, the material, and the female, the male?
No, I think the doc has got it here. He hasn't exactly nailed it perfectly, but got enough to get the reward. So he gets the gift card.
I give it to somebody else. I don't go to Starbucks. You don't go to
Starbucks.
Anyway. Well,
you can give it to somebody else. That's the choice. I give it to the winner. You can choose to bless whoever you want to bless. Okay, parturition is the action of giving birth to young. It's childbirth. Okay, it is childbirth. That's what it is. And so he was right. I mean, he's got the right idea. It's the process of actually birthing children. So in this last section, we do that. Starbucks. Somebody under 20 wants a Starbucks. How has the world changed? Okay, so parturition. All right, so teasing aside, somebody read the first five verses for me. 38, 1 to 5. Okay, so on the heels of the events, Judah leaves safely. I think, I don't remember who said it, but yeah, I think he probably couldn't handle it, and there is somewhat sequential action here, so he departs. And he goes to, he leaves the safety of the family to pursue a wife. Now, what's wrong with what Judah's doing? What's wrong with what he's doing? What's wrong about this situation? I don't know sign language.
He's mixing.
He's mixing, okay, right? So he's mixing. What else is wrong?
Is there marriage? I mean, it didn't mention marriage at all.
Well, no, but yeah, he does say he does marry.
It says he married her and made
love
to her. Yeah. And he chooses on his own.
Goes out and chooses on his own, which means?
God did not choose.
Well, also means that his father's not involved
right,
in this process.
Right, against all of the traditions of the time.
Right, so he's not involved in procuring a wife, and then second, Judah marries, mixing. Good one. Sorry to get that one. He's mixing with the pagan woman, right? So from the text, it's hard to determine whether Judah's failure is entirely his own. So is he just demonstrating headstrong kind of rebellion or impatience, or Is it Jacob's lackadaisical parenting? And I think we can probably attribute it to a bit of both. So regardless of which, intermarriage had been regressively avoided earlier, right, in Genesis 34. They didn't do any intermarrying from a rather aggressive thing, but not so here. Reminding us that if we do not establish safe boundaries from the world, we are inevitably going to become entangled with it. Now, this is a challenging kind of balance, right? Because we're told to be salt and light in the world, right? We're also told to go, right, and make disciples. So the fact is that we are told to do that. We are told to be in the world, but we're not supposed to be of the world, okay? So that's kind of the key distinction here. You're not of the world in the process. So, because the minority always runs the risk of being overcome by and conforming to the majority. Right? It always happens, right? When you're in the minority, what do you want to do? You want to conform, right? You want to be part of the majority. So the temptation is always there to want to conform to what's around you. Now, what New Testament principles does Judah violate in this marriage? Exactly right. Okay, so 2 Corinthians 6:14, don't be unequally yoked, which is a command. And then, of course, in that big chapter in chapter 7, this is with widows, of course, is the context, or remarrying, but only in the Lord, right? So look, marriage is what? Already hard enough if you got two believers in the game, right? We had some interesting charges on our Friday night 30-minute, which was 60 minutes, I guess, once we got done. But it was interesting, you know, some memorial stones. But the fact of the matter is that life is hard enough in marriage if you're married to another believer. So why would you add to the equation, make it even harder, right? You're kind of like talking two different languages. So like all unchecked sin, his initial sin is going to lead to more and progressively worse sin. He's going to break a promise. He's going to have relations with a prostitute and play the hypocrite, reminding us that sin's tentacles, right, are just as entangling as the world, right? It's just like an octopus. It's got all these different arms, and it's just going to keep grabbing on you if you don't radically cut it off. So despite our sin, God works in the midst of human failures. Namely here, he goes on to bless the union with three sons. As Danae inflected, and then another one. Right? Three sons right in a row, Onan, and Shelah. Okay, so three sons. Though as the narrative is going to reveal, at least the first two were wicked, right? They weren't good boys. So I'll read the next section here to keep us moving. 6 to 11, now Judah took a wife for his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Judah's firstborn was evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord took his life. Then Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife and perform your duty as the brother-in-law to her, and raise up offspring for your brother. Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. So when he went into his brother's wife, he wasted his seed on the ground in order not to give offspring to his brother. But what he did was displeasing in the sight of the Lord, so he took his life also. Then Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up, for he thought, I am afraid that he too may die like his brothers. So Tamar went and lived in her father's house. All right, so verses 6 to 11 record her ill-fated union to the first two sons. Unlike his father, Judah does get the first part of the equation right, right? What does Judah do correctly?
Tells his other son to go in and...
Well, before that, even to get started. What?
He picks him a wife.
Right, he picks him a wife, takes the lead in finding a wife. What part does he get wrong? He pursues the wrong bride pool.
Right.
Okay, now, again, he's already made the bad choice himself. He keeps the process going. So God takes the husband, number one's life, who was evil in the sight of the Lord. Okay, so reminding us, God is long-suffering. There's no question about that. But he will intervene and take action when there is persistent wickedness, right? The guy's evil. That's a strong Old Testament word. He's an evil guy. So this is the first recorded instance of God taking an individual's life like this for this purpose. We certainly saw him wipe out all of humanity back in Genesis earlier, right? But here we see that God will actually intervene to that level. Now we get some interesting theological puzzles in the New Testament on that, so we won't go there because we don't have time, but based upon prevailing ancient Near East custom, the second born was given to the wife so that the deceased son would have an heir. Okay, so this is the process of levirate marriage from the Old Testament. Okay, so when the firstborn dies, has not produced an heir, then the second born goes in as the husband and does the process. Now, Judah instructed his son Onan to do. We're not told the nature of Ur's wickedness, but Onan's is rather graphically spelled out. So maybe this is why Leupold doesn't like it. Namely, he uses Tamar for his physical pleasure and deliberately avoids conception. Okay, so it's just abusive in terms of what he's doing. It's just having sport. And from his name comes the English word onanism. We are not going to have a giveaway for this. You can look it up on your own, okay, in the name of discretion. All right, but the fact of the matter is, it was wicked. So this act was sin of commission, right, in the Old Testament called sinning with a high hand versus one of omission, which means it was premeditated sin. It is the highest form of sin that we see in the Old Testament. Not only high-handed, Onan's sin was persistent. So when it says when he went in, it's actually better translated whenever. So this wasn't just one time. This was kind of a persistent process that was going on in the relationship. Now, based on verse 9, what was his motive? What was his motive in not producing an heir? Come on, Jim. You had this one before. All right, he wants all the inheritance, okay? He wants all the firstborn stuff. He knows if he produces an heir and a son, he will forfeit that. So God then intervened and took Onan's life. Now, what should have happened next? Her's dead, Onan's dead. What should have happened next?
The next son
should have been committed, all right? Now, Judah should have pledged him to Tamar and kept her in his home. What does he do instead? Well, he gives the appearance of conformance, right? He doesn't commit him right away. He just says, you go off and live with your parents, which he shouldn't have done. She should have stayed in his household. He should have been responsible in caring for her. And he's somewhat equivocal. So again, we see the family DNA, right? He kind of gives the impression he's going to give her the third son, but he kind of dodges the issue at that point in time. How do we know? Because of 11b, he was afraid that Shelah would die. Okay, so he was afraid. We know what his motive is. I get it. Okay, you know, I can understand his concern, but what does his fear expose? What does his fear expose?
That he doesn't trust God.
Exactly right. A wrong attribution of blame. Okay, and Judah supposes she's the problem. That's one thing, but I think I have the question a little further. He doesn't trust God in the process either. Okay. So he's attributing the problem to Tamar. He's not looking at the evil nature of his sons. How else will we know that she's not to blame? Because she is in the messianic line, okay? So we see how God works through her. Now, what other women does the Bible name in Jesus' genealogy? What other women?
Rahab,
and what's Rahab?
Prostitute,
okay. Who else? Ruth, yeah, that's a good one. Okay, she's probably the icon of it, right? Who else? Bathsheba, right? So she participated in the act with David. She was, you know, clearly hard to turn down the king, but I don't think she was completely clean in the process. And then who else? Don't miss the obvious one.
Mary.
Okay, very good. Okay, his mama. All right, so Rahab, Ruth, Bathsheba, and Mary, and of course we get that from the genealogy in Matthew, and these are the women specified by name, okay, that he calls out. So the practice on display in this chapter is later codified in the Mosaic Law. It's called levirate marriage. In the interest of time, let me just give you the Deuteronomy reference. You can read it on your own, Deuteronomy 25, 5-10, but it explains how this becomes codified in their civil law in the book of Leviticus as we go through, Deuteronomy. Also, we see it in Leviticus as well. So again, what Old Testament book fully illustrates this levirate concept? Where do we see it really wonderfully? Which Old Testament book? Yeah? Ruth, right, okay. I mean, that's the whole point of the book, right? It's actually something specific there called the Goel, which is a kinsman redeemer. And this concept extends more than just the marriage. It redeems property, you redeem a person, and it also redeems blood, okay, or an avenger, if you will, in the process. So this concept is in their law. Now, let me see if I can get through a bit more here. So I'm going to read 12-19. Now, after a considerable time, Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. And when the time of mourning was ended, Judah went up to his sheep shearers at Timnah, He and his friend Hira the Adullamite. It was told to Tamar, "Behold, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep." So she removed her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil and wrapped herself and sat in the gateway of Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah, for she saw that Shelah had grown up and she had not been given to him as a wife. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot, for she had covered her face. So he turned aside to her by the road and said, "Here now, let me come in to you," for he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, "What will you give me that you may come in to me?" He said, "Therefore, I will send you a young goat from the flock." She said, "Moreover, will you give a pledge until you send it?" He said, "What pledge shall I give you?" And she said, "Your seal and your cord, and your staff that is in your hand." So he gave them to her and went in to her, and she conceived by him. Then she arose and departed and removed her veil and put on the widow's garments. Okay, so we know her plight. Now we come to see her plan, both that and the execution thereof. Presents us with an interesting moral question, I think, though, right? So you see this with Rahab a bit as well. Do rightful or righteous ends justify sinful means? What do you think?
No.
Yeah, they probably don't, okay. I think the right answer to that is no. Well, what lies, no pun intended, at the core of sinful means? And got it a little earlier.
Unbelief.
Yeah, unbelief, right? And a lack of trust in God's sovereignty, right? Really, that's what underlies it, right?
She wanted to be in control.
Right. We want to be in charge. Is that right? We want to be on the throne. Doug?
It's amazing, though, that she would go out there. I mean, that's God's providential will and opportunity. There's no other guys to find out. Just Judah, we see as a case of, and then when they come, they say, well, there was never a harlot.
Right.
So it wasn't a common thing.
Right, exactly right. So we see that there is no such thing. Of course, we see how he deals with that. So in all of that, Tamar is pursuing her customary right to produce an heir. I mean, that's what she's doing. She's doing what she would have done in that culture at that time. Her chosen means are unsavory, but she is a pagan, right? Operating under pagan principles. So let's notice that first. There is no law at this time, right? What does Romans 5 tell us? You know, in the absence of law, there's no transgression. Right, so we don't have law at that point in time, which is the purpose of the law. And God blesses her and Rahab, another one, as women in Jesus' genealogical line. So why does God work with people like this? There you go. Thank you. That's all he's got, except for the one, right, that came and he had perfection. Right.
You're
like, you know, he's got a bad pool to pick from.
But it also shows us that we should work with all.
Yeah, sure. Sure, but we don't want to, I mean, how do you mean that? Where would you go with that?
Well, but, you know, in the ways of testimony and being kind and loving.
Okay, that's good. I like that. I'm not going to witness to prostitutes by frequenting prostitutes, and I'm not going to witness to drunks by being in the bar.
No, but
yeah, but you're right. Yeah, we shouldn't dismiss anybody is your point.
I mean, the doctor doesn't doctor to well people.
Right.
Yeah, not only that, yeah. No matter how bad we have been in the past,
yeah.
God can still use us
yeah.
in the future.
Well, that's right. Exactly right. That's right, Megan.
Well, and that's me. Like, that's what I do.
Right.
Like, I want my children to obey. Therefore, it's okay for me to get angry at them. Well, but I'm just helping them obey. Like, they're sinning.
Yeah.
God does say in Ephesians 6:1,
yeah.
children obey your parents.
Yeah.
And I'm not a pagan anymore.
Right.
I am a new creation.
Yeah.
And I'm still doing what Tamar.
Exactly right. Exactly right. It's a great example. Really, really good example. And it's hard, right? Yeah, Jim.
You know, back to what you said earlier about intermarrying a believer and an unbeliever. To me, there was no real evidence that Judah was a believer at the time this all this was going on.
Yeah.
He was a pagan himself, I believe. There's no desire on his part to do anything right.
Yeah.
It's all wrong. So
yeah, arguably you're right.
The fact that he intermarried
can't
be a natural thing if he's still a pagan at the time.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
So,
yeah, we don't know. You know, you would think that he was had some good teaching
just
growing the family.
Doing now.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I agree. That's fair. Absolutely fair. Okay. So God can work in and through our sinful choices, but as the acknowledgement of sin increases, as the knowledge of sin increases, so will our accountability. Right. So God will work through these things. But there will come a time, right, that even if God blesses a sinful action, we're still going to be what? Held accountable for it. Right? You're still going to be held accountable for it. So don't think just because God blessed it, you know, you're not accountable for it. You know, those interviews must go fast, because I'm sure he's got a long list of stuff. So maybe we get like supernatural quick, you know. That's why he transforms us, so we can see in an instant just how bad we were, right, before he gets on to the good stuff. But come on in. So as I say, in heaven there are no bad jobs. You know, could be a janitor, could be this. They're all going to be good. All right, so we are going to. So reminding us by way of implication of Romans 6, right? What's the rhetorical question that Paul poses there? Well, since grace abounds, should we sin all the more? Well, no, of course not, right? Do we appeal to God's grace as the reason and justification for our sinning? I hope not. You know, we can call on his grace for forgiveness as we repent, right? But I certainly hope we don't make that a justification for sin in our lives. So the plan is straightforward with a wise twist, right? So his wife had died. The mourning period was over. He goes to the festivities. We see that he did honor his wife, right, after her death, but he demonstrates his entanglement with the world. Tamar sets the trap in verse 14, recognizing that he had come of age, okay? So I've done my part. I've been in the house. I've been wearing the widow's clothes, but you haven't done your part yet. Now, her plan raises a question in my mind. It's an interesting plan. What question does her plan raise in your mind?
What if somebody else had come along?
Well, okay, that's kind of close to it. What if somebody else had come along first? She could have said, that's not enough. And she goes, it's a bad kid. I don't want that, right? What else did it raise? Just kind of thinking.
What if Judah doesn't notice?
Yeah, what if Judah doesn't notice? What made her think Judah would bite?
Yeah.
Right? What made her think he'd bite? I mean, so there's something. I think I have to go back to appeal to my brother Jim here. Judah's character was probably not so good. All right, so probably he was displaying pagan tendencies in his life and so forth, but what would he bite? Well, he does bite in 15 to 16a, right? They negotiate the terms, the base terms, right? But she has a wise twist, right? What's the wise twist that she has to the terms?
Collateral.
Collateral, right. She wants a pledge, all right? She wants a collateral pledge. So has thought things through and exhausted a pledge. So you see that it is not a carnal desire on her part because of the way she's acting through the process. She's setting it up because she knows what's going to happen, right, once she's found to be pregnant. All right, so the plan works. The two parties go their separate ways. All right, I'm going to go quick here, 2023. And then Judah sent the young goat by his friend, the Adullamite, to receive the pledge from the woman's hand. He did not find her. He asked the man of the place, saying, where is the temple prostitute who is by the road to Enaim? But they said, ain't no temple prostitutes here. Okay, just like Doug said, that's the Steve Smith version. So he returned to Judah and said, I did not find her. And furthermore, the men of the place said, there has been no temple prostitute here. Then Judah said, let her keep them. Otherwise, what? We're going to become a laughing stock. After all, I sent this young goat, but you did not find her. It's like, hey, I did my part, right? So, blah, 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 right. Judah dispatches Hira to settle the debt, only to discover he has been duped, okay? So, what is Judah's response, right? What's his response? He only wants to save face, right? So, what else is interesting about the fact that this is his only response?
He doesn't care.
Yeah, he doesn't care. He doesn't seem to generate any thoughtful reflection on what happened, right? All he wants to do is make sure he doesn't become a laughingstock of everybody around. So God hasn't gotten his attention yet, right? He hasn't gotten his attention yet in the process. So we're going to have to go a little bit further in 24 to 26, and he will. Now it was about 3 months later that Judah was informed, your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the harlot, and behold, she is also with child by harlotry. Then Judah said, bring her out and let her be burned. Wow, that's pretty nasty. It was while she was being brought out that she sent to her father-in-law, saying, I'm with child by the man whom these things belong to. And she said, please examine and see whose signet ring and cords and staff these are. So Judah recognized them and said, she is more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give her to my son, Shelah, and he did not have relations with her again. Okay, so sin doesn't stay hidden for long, okay? It is soon revealed that she's pregnant out of wedlock. Now, how do you feel about Judah's response?
Well,
Yeah, I don't know. I'd say hypocritical at best at the moment.
Really? Yeah. I'm talking about 26.
Yeah, the lights do come on at the end. You're absolutely right, okay? Perhaps also with a mixture of relief, right? Oh, she's pregnant, okay. I don't have to give her shelah now in the process. So Tamar springs her defense, right? To which he finally fesses up, okay? He's got no way around this. This is his seal and his staff, which would have both been very distinctive. Now, what does Judah exhibit in verse 26? What does he finally exhibit by verse 26? What's that? Yeah, some humility. I think he's finally showing some genuine repentance. You know, Doug said it earlier. He finally gets it, okay? He says she's more righteous than I. Now, righteous is not a great translation. It's actually the verb. She is more in the right than I. So he recognizes that she did her part. He did not do his part, and he acknowledges that. So, you know, we don't see this kind of full-blown confession and restoration and repentance in the process, but we do see a pretty clear confession, okay? Hey, you know what? She's right. I'm wrong. And, of course, he doesn't act on what the verdict was. She doesn't get burned. She has the children, and he doesn't go into her again. So he honors her from that point forward, whether she came to live in his household or not, I don't know. So he acknowledges she's more right than he because he did not honor the promise and give her son when she instructed. So she is spared, and Judah has no further relations with her. Last section. Sorry, I'm flying. It came about at the time she was giving birth that, behold, there were twins in her womb. Moreover, it took place while she was giving birth. One put out a hand, and the midwife took it and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, this one came out first. But it came about as he drew back his hand that, behold, his brother came out. Then she said, what a breach you have made for yourself. So he was named Perez, which means breach. Afterward, his brother came out, who had the scarlet thread in his hand, and he was named Zerah. Okay, so the episode ends with the tension turning to the birth of Judah's progeny. As with his father, there were twins, okay? And just like with his father's twins, they were struggling in the womb. Why does Moses record the births of these two, Perez and Zerah? Right, because Perez is going to be part of the messianic line in the process, okay? Goes through Perez. All in all, really a sordid chapter, right? But nevertheless, fruitful for our study, because we see God's providence working through people's sinful choices, right? So, you know, while it is sordid, it is assuring, right? Because it says he can work through our sinful choices, and God's going to accomplish his purposes. Not excusing their failures, but accomplishing his purposes. That's the key, for which they will be accountable one day, right? So even though God may work through it, you are going to be held accountable for those sinful choices. So next week, we will return to Joseph and his time in Egypt. Thank you for letting me race, because I got a race. Ken, would you close us up with a word, please?
Father, we again want to...